This is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. And it's my pleasure to welcome Adam Friedman, who is a contributor at Ricochet.com, as well as a contributor to the Manhattan Institute's PointOfLaw.com web magazine, and author of a new book on constitutional interpretive theory called The Naked Constitution. So welcome, Adam. We're here today to talk about a case that was just argued before the U.S. Supreme Court, Fisher v. University of Texas. And that case, I guess, is figures to be the third in the great line of university affirmative action cases that started with Bakke in the late 1970s that first embraced, or at least one justice embraced, and then implicitly the others followed, the diversity rationale for race discrimination and on behalf of disfavored minority groups in university admissions. Subsequently refined about a decade ago in 2003 with the companion Bollinger cases coming out of Michigan, and now we've got the Fisher case for University of Texas. So first of all, just Adam, walk us through sort of this baseline constitutional jurisprudence, as it were, involving affirmative action in higher education with Bakke and then the Bollinger cases and sort of where we stand going into the Fisher case.
Sure, Jim. And hi, thanks for having me on the podcast. It's great to be on. The issue, the constitutional issue for your listeners is the Equal Protection Clause. On its face, for any state university or any state program to favor one racial group over another is a violation of the Equal Protection Clause's guarantee. That issue in the context of university admissions came up for decision, as you note, in the 1978 Bakke case, which produced a splintered Supreme Court decision, and the sort of controlling voice, Justice Powell, as you note, either for himself or maybe sort of for the other justices, rejected most of the arguments in favor of racial preferences, but held that the educational benefits flowing from a diverse student body could be a compelling state interest that would justify racial preferences, thereby getting over strict scrutiny, provided that the solution is narrowly tailored. And he held that a quota system would not be narrowly tailored, but a kind of plus factor for racial groups, for certain racial groups, would be permissible. In Grutter versus Bollinger, that was the 2003 case involving the University of Michigan Law School's racial preferences. Again, the court, in a decision authored by Justice O'Connor, held that, or sort of reaffirmed that diversity could be a compelling state interest and that a plus factor type system could be narrowly tailored to achieve that interest, and also, interestingly and relevant for this new case, held that a university did not have to exhaust all of the non-racial means to attain a diverse student body in order to meet the narrow tailoring factor.
So what does that mean?
Well, so there are various ways that a university could go about attaining a racial mixture among its student bodies. And in the University of Texas case that's now before the Supreme Court, one of the arguments is that the university has already achieved a diverse student body using a race-neutral means, and that's their so-called 10% law. By law, they are required to offer acceptance to the top 10 students in all Texas public high schools. That is the University of Texas's flagship university at Austin has to accept the top 10%. That has increased racial diversity by a significant percentage. And the opponents of further racial preferences say you don't need any further preferences because you've got this top 10% law. The contrary argument, unfortunately, in my view, is supplied by Grutter's opinion that says you don't have to rely on race neutral means in order to achieve narrow tailoring. You can go beyond or even ignore race neutral means and still be narrowly tailored to meet your compelling interest.
Interesting. So the Fisher case, if Texas already lets in the top 10% anyway. What's the claim in the Fisher case? How does this differ from what was the court decided in Grutter?
Well, the difference is that in Grutter there was evidence presented in the lower courts that said that without racial preferences, minority enrollment in University of Michigan Law School would be very small indeed. I can't remember the exact percentages, but it would be a single digit, very low percent, 2-3%, something like that. In the Texas case, the top 10% law had already increased an already diverse student body by a couple of percentage points. So with African Americans and Hispanics, who are sort of the two most relevant groups for this law, taken into account, they're in the mid to high teens, depending on the year.
And the main reason, I guess, is because being in the top 10% of your class doesn't take into account, say, SAT scores or other things with different racial impacts. Plus, people obviously are concentrated, different racial groups are concentrated in different places around the state, so that certain areas are more disproportionately Black or disproportionately Hispanic or whatever.
That's right. So top 10%, it means whether you're an inner city high school, a rural high school, et cetera. And this is where, in my opinion, the Texas's argument really breaks down or exposes a certain faulty reasoning, because the lawyer for the university said, yeah, you get diversity, but it's not the right kind of diversity, because the students are all coming from segregated, the minority students are coming from segregated high schools, in other words, disproportionately Black or Hispanic high schools. So now they've moved the goalposts on Grutter. It's not just enough to have a quote-unquote critical mass of minority students. Those minority students themselves have to come from diversified high schools, which essentially means those are students who either have to come from affluent parents who live in racially mixed neighborhoods or who are going to racially mixed private schools.
Interesting. And I guess by definition aren't within the top 10%, right? This is basically around the more, after they let in the top 10% of all the students, they still want some wiggle room in their admissions office to let in other special types of students. I mean, clearly the top football players on the Texas football team, the children of important alumni or whatever, and they want to be able to say, we still also want to be able to use race outside that, even though there's a critical mass on the basis of race or ethnicity, there's not a critical mass of people that are coming from high schools with lots and lots of white students.
That's right. And the unpleasant reality is that the system in Fisher, the system at issue in Fisher, is really a windfall for upper middle class minority students with middling grades.
Interesting. So the court's obviously changed somewhat since 2003. Senator Day O'Connor's no longer on the court, nor is the Chief Justice Rehnquist, but we've got John Roberts and Sam Alito in on the court now. I think Elena Kagan's recused from this case, but to some degree superfluous, because it's going to either be 4-4 or 5-3, perhaps, would be my guess on this case, based on how Justice Kennedy and Scalia and Thomas have come down in the past, or at least how they did in the Michigan case. What can we elucidate from the oral argument in terms of how the justices might be thinking on this, and what do you think a likely outcome here is?
Well, that's right. A 4-4 decision would mean effectively that the lower court, the Fifth Circuit's decision, stands, and the Fifth Circuit upheld the Texas system.
Right.
You have, from the dissenters in Grutter, Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy are still on the court. And so when you throw in Alito and Roberts, the other allegedly conservative justices, that could be a majority of 5. From the oral argument, Certainly, all of the typically conservative justices, except for Thomas, who did not speak in oral argument, as is his custom.
Which is typical, right?
Which is his custom, that's right. They all expressed skepticism. Kennedy is somewhat Delphic, but if he goes along with his dissent in Grutter, then it really comes down to how Alito and Kennedy go. And they were very, very skeptical of the Texas system. Roberts kept asking sort of deeper and deeper questions. Well, who identifies Hispanic? How do you count a Hispanic? What if you're 1/8 Hispanic? What if you're 1/32 Hispanic? Really kind of getting at the absurdity of racial classifications.
Fascinating. And I guess before we wrap this up, I'd just be sort of interested, and this is probably outside the record of the Fisher case, but something we're interested in here anyway, because these are some folks that we've been following in our Center for the American University, and that's law professor Richard Sanders got a new book out with legal journalist and attorney Stuart Taylor, that whom we've worked with in a number of other capacities in the past, on their new book, Mismatch, precisely on this point, although they're really not focusing so much on the rights of the plaintiffs here. In other words, the white students denied admission on the basis of affirmative action policies. But they're actually arguing that the affirmative action policies negatively impact the admitted students themselves. Is that at all relevant to this case? And how do you think that may or may not shape some of the justices' minds here? Or particularly Justice Thomas, who I think's focused on this sort of argument in the past in some of his writings.
Yeah, well, I don't think it will influence, I doubt whether it will influence this case because of the deference that the court affords to university, and this goes back to Grutter, the deference to a university that just asserts that diversity is a compelling state interest. But I think that as this kind of research gets more accepted, the idea that diversity is a compelling interest with educational benefits will get debunked, and it will not, I think, in the future be able to hold up as a compelling state interest.
Fascinating. So that's been, a very good sort of summary and preview of the Fisher case. We may come back and talk about it after the court comes down and try to make sense of the decision as the court determines where it's going to go here and releases its opinion, probably this spring or next June, if it decides it's here within the normal scope of the October term. So again, this is James R. Copeland, the director of the Center for Legal Policy at the Manhattan Institute. It's been my pleasure to have with us Adam Friedman, a contributor at Ricochet, as well as at our own pointoflaw.com legal web magazine and author of the new book, The Naked Constitution, looking at how we should be interpreting the Constitution. So thanks, Adam.
Thanks, James.